Tonight on the Daily Debrief, new details about the Colorado dad who admitted to killing his wife and children. And Michael Jackson's estate lashes out at a documentary accusing the late singer of sex abuse. Plus, the case of a Florida cop who shot and killed a motorist. The state's recording from the scene may not be telling us everything.
You're 100% certain that there's a human voice spoken before the words, huh?
Yes.
The nation's top criminal cases are on the Daily Debrief. It's Tuesday, March 5th. And good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief tonight. I'm Aaron Keller. New details tonight in the case of a Colorado father who pleaded guilty to murdering his family. Chris Watts issued that plea in court late last year. However, investigators have remained working his case. This Thursday, Colorado authorities have promised to release new information about what happened. In the meantime, an attorney for the parents of Chris's wife and murder victim, Shannon Watts, says the whole thing started when Chris revealed an affair. Here is some of that attorney's interview on Dr. Phil.
He essentially confessed to having an affair, that he wanted a divorce, that it was pretty much over between them. And she had said something to the effect of, well, you're not gonna see the kids again. As a consequence of that conversation, he strangled her to death.
Did Bella witness any of that? Did she walk in while he was wrapping her?
Bella walked in and asked, what are you doing with mommy?
That attorney also says Watts killed his daughters because one of them saw him disposing of his wife's body. Watts is serving a number of life sentences. He apparently killed his family so he could have a fresh start with a mistress. Explosive accusations in an HBO film about the king of pop, Michael Jackson. Two men portrayed in the film say Jackson groomed them as boys and groomed their families. He then took them to his Neverland Ranch, where he set up a mock wedding for one and got them to sleep in his bedroom, where they say things became sexual. The film is creating a stir on social media and backlash. The Michael Jackson estate sent this letter to HBO and provided a copy to Law and Crime. It reads in part, contrary to all norms of documentary filmmaking, the estate was never contacted, the letter reads. As to the accusers, these two men have been peddling their false story for years now after engaging in failed legal actions against the estate. HBO's documentary is based solely on the words of two admitted perjurers. Those words from the estate of Michael Jackson. Joining me tonight is investigative reporter Diane Diamond, author of the book, Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case. Diane, good to see you here on The Debrief. Good evening.
Thanks for having me, Aaron.
Okay, so two men are making strong claims here after claiming in Jackson's trial that they were not abused. So should people believe them this time around?
Well, you know, actually only Wade Robson testified at the 2005 criminal trial, but the other young boy did do a deposition in the 1993 allegation case. There's been two allegations here. Six men in all have come forward to claim Michael Jackson molested them. Should we believe them? Well, you know, Aaron, have we learned nothing from the way child sex abuse victims report? Just look at all the cases from the Catholic Church, for example. People coming forward 10, 20, 30 years later, they'd always denied anything happened, but then finally, somehow, some way, they come forward and they make their allegations. And that's what we've seen here. I don't think it's any big surprise that people, alleged victims, survivors, they call themselves, wait to actually tell their truth to the public.
You've covered Michael Jackson for years. So what do people need to know about him in light of these latest accusations in this film?
Well, you know, I get an awful lot of mail from the fans of Michael Jackson, and they are absolutely correct. He was a fabulous entertainer. He gave a lot of money to charities. He had an innocent persona. He appeared to be a loving man. But as we learn more and more about pedophiles, all of those good things can be true, and they can still be flawed individuals who would rather have sex with a child than with someone their own age. And I think perhaps time has told us now. You're right, I've been covering this since 1993. I wrote the book in 2005 after I covered the criminal trial. I think that the time has told us now six young men have come forward to say the same thing. Six young men who didn't know each other, really, who could not have gotten together to concoct these stories. And I think we're in an era now where we listen to victims, and we should listen to them.
Am I reading you incorrectly to suspect that you believe the victims and that you believe Michael Jackson did this?
You're not listening to me incorrectly. I think after all this time, I can safely say that, yes. I think that Michael Jackson fits the profile of a pedophile. The FBI has one on record. You should read it. Every single thing in that profile seems to fit Michael Jackson precisely.
Wow, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, he created a persona and a place of residence that was very attractive to kids. Look at Neverland, a petting zoo and a theater and swimming pools. And he surrounded himself with children all the time, very nearly daring the public to think ill of him. You know, we were blinded by celebrity back in 1993. Nobody wanted to talk about this back then. Now it's a topic of discussion.
Yeah, I mean, so maybe he fits the profile, but does so on a grand platform because he had so much money to make this estate and everything. It's an interesting observation. Certainly, the estate itself, though, is complaining about the film's journalistic practices, saying, wait a minute, you can't call this a documentary unless you reach out to everybody that you could possibly reach out to, and then and only then can you claim objectivity. You've worked as a journalist. I have, too. Do you think the filmmakers should have at least taken that step?
Well, you know, a documentary is whatever its filmmaker wants it to be. And I've listened to Dan Reed. I don't know the man, but he says that this isn't really a story about Michael Jackson. But he says it rather is the story of two child sex abuse survivors. And so when you look at it that way, I looked at the documentary very carefully. I watched the 1 hour with Oprah afterward, and it really was about the struggle of these two young men. Believe them or not, when you look at their faces, there's some trauma there. They're both in therapy. Safechuck especially looks like he's having a very rough time of keeping it together. Something happened to these young men. And, you know, the estate can say what it wants. What's it supposed to say? Oh, yeah, go ahead, say whatever you want about Michael. They're there to argue against things like this. But
exactly.
I'll tell you what, I think this is a really rough time for that estate.
Oh, certainly. There's millions of dollars on the line here still because he has intellectual property rights to songs and whatnot, a lot of money riding on this, and things change as the story continues to roll forward.
Now,
so, Diane Diamond, we appreciate you joining us on The Debrief tonight.
You bet. One quick thing. Canadian radio and BBC radio have decided not to play his music anymore. That's going to be a hit to the estate.
Oh, certainly. Again, a lot of money riding on this. So, Diane, thanks for interjecting that. I appreciate it. We'll catch you next time as the story develops.
You bet.
Moving along now, the State Bar of Arizona has filed a 22-page complaint against the man who successfully prosecuted Jody Arias. That complaint accuses Juan Martinez of leaking confidential information during the Arias murder case. It also says he lied to bar investigators and even sexually harassed people at work. Some female employees are said in the complaint to have kept a list of his unprofessional conduct. Those are the accusations that he will have to answer. Still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, the latest in a case we've been following out of California, the murder of the McStay family. All prosecutors say because of money. Plus, a former police officer faces attempted murder charges in Florida. Intense arguments about audio recordings and conflicting testimony from doctors. That is after the break. Welcome back, everybody. Opening statements are expected late this week in the case of an Iowa man accused of murdering his mother over money. Jason Carter is the defendant. Shirley Carter is the victim. The defendant's father sued him in civil court after Shirley's death. A jury ruled in the father's favor and awarded him $10 million. Prosecutors stepped in and filed criminal charges against Jason, citing evidence from the civil case. Jury selection will take another couple of days before opening statements kick off. Another pause in the trial of a California man accused of killing a family of four. Prosecutors say defendant Chase Merritt murdered his business partner, Joseph McStay, and McStay's entire family because he needed money. The state rested but will call one more witness next week. So court is on hold until then. Then it's the defense's turn. The McSay family disappeared in 2010. A dirt biker found their bodies buried in the desert in 2013. Closing arguments will take place tomorrow in the case of a Florida police officer who shot and killed a stranded African-American motorist. Here's a look at the basic case.
Reggae drummer Corey Jones was driving home at 3 in the morning when his car broke down on a Florida interstate. He pulled off to the side of an exit ramp. Shortly later, police officer Newman Raja pulled up in front of him. In this police video, less than 5 hours after the incident, Raja tells his side of the story, still dressed in the clothes he was wearing when he pulled the trigger.
I said, "Hey man, police, can I help you?" The second I said police, he jumped back, and I clearly remember him drawing and pointing a gun at me. I saw that silver muzzle, and he had, I can swear on this, he had a Laser Max laser in the guide rod in the gun, and I saw that red light of that Laser Max flashing at me.
But Jones was on the phone with roadside assistance. Nowhere in the recorded call does Raja identify himself as a police officer.
I'm good. Y'all good? Yeah.
Take your fucking hands up. Take your fucking hands up.
Oh my God.
Prosecutors are basically accusing Raja of lying, not just about identifying himself, but also about the laser sight he claims was on the victim's gun.
Did that appear to be a Laser Max laser to you?
It did not appear to be. That gun has an enclosed guide rod anyway. That gun wouldn't be compatible with the Laser Max laser.
Even fellow officers questioned Raja's tactics.
Is it paramount to the safety of the officer to make sure that they are clearly identifiable to a person that they're conducting a traffic stop on?
Yes.
Raja was driving an unmarked van. Prosecutors say there's no way Jones would have known he was a cop.
He's wearing jeans. He's wearing an inside-out T-shirt, a hat. No badge, nothing. That's not how an officer talks to a citizen at 3 o'clock in the morning on the side of the road. He's actually chasing Corey Jones away from his vehicle.
Raja argues the shooting was in self-defense, since he claims Jones pulled a gun on him, which Jones usually kept in the glove compartment.
Fence disputes the recording presented by the state, which suggests Raja said nothing about being a police officer. The defense's own expert said someone spoke at the beginning of the recording, but their enhancement could not pick up the words spoken.
How do you know it's a voice?
Going through those three stages I mentioned earlier, we know the voice falls in a frequency area, that the voices are in, and I'm going to get a little geeky here, 350 to 700 frequency range. And those voices are, the voices that I've detected there are in that frequency range.
So it's because of the frequency range that you know it's a human voice instead of a dog barking or whatever.
That's one of the characteristics that is telling me that it's a voice. It's not, yet there are many, like you suggested, there are many sounds that could be in that frequency range as well. But this particular voice is definitely in that range. So that's one area.
Now, let me ask you this about the first enhanced version.
Yeah.
When you did that first enhanced version, were you able to conclude that it was a human voice?
Yes.
And how certain are you that it was a human voice?
100% certain.
Okay. So you're 100% sure by the time you get to the first enhanced version, and there's more to come, right? There's super enhanced.
Yeah, the next enhanced version will be the best way to present it today.
Okay, but I want to be clear. So you're 100% certain that there's a human voice spoken before the words, huh?
Yes.
Forced that same defense expert to admit he earlier testified he was only 50% sure. Competing experts have also testified about whether the victim, Corey Jones, could have kept running after he was shot in the chest. One bullet fired from the front struck Jones in the heart and caused massive damage. Another fired from the back struck Jones in the back of the arm. The defense wants jurors to believe Jones kept moving and still posed a threat during the second volley of gunshots, which were likely fired when Jones was running away. The state's expert says it's unlikely Jones could have stayed on his feet.
When we're looking at this photograph of the heart, what about Corey Jones's heart in this photograph has been blown apart? What areas?
The top portion of his heart is blown away. He has a hole that started, the bullet hit the right side of the heart, the top, which is the atrium. The atrium, there are two chambers in the heart, two on top and two at the bottom. And the two on top are where the muscle is very thin and it's not very thick. The bottom is where most of the mass, the muscle mass of the heart is.
Once you see that his heart has been virtually blown apart, how far would they be able to travel? I mean, are they gonna, let me ask you this way. Are they going to, is a person who sustains a gunshot wound to the heart like this, is that person going to just drop like a sack of potatoes immediately?
Not necessarily, no.
Okay.
No.
And why not?
I have to answer slowly because gunshot wounds to the heart are different. You don't have all gunshot wounds to the heart being the same. But in this particular instance, you have somebody whose output from the main pump of his body has been cut off.
You said the output from the main pump?
Main pump, which is the heart. Mm-hmm. It's totally cut off. At this particular time, what I expect to happen is that there is going to be a sudden drop in blood pressure into the body. And you have to...
You said a sudden drop. So what happens when that sudden drop happens?
When you have a sudden drop of blood pressure, you start fainting immediately. You faint, you become dizzy. When you have a sudden drop in blood pressure, you become dizzy, you experience fainting, and you eventually pass out.
So that's the state's theory. The defense, however, called the chief state medical examiner, who says Jones could have kept moving despite the massive trauma to his aorta.
Could Mr. Jones have run the 40 or 50 yards in question subsequent to, afterwards, that he received the injury to his heart?
The short answer is yes, he could have.
How clear is the literature on that?
I think it's quite clear. I authored a 6-page letter that reviews the literature with regard to this very specific point. And anyone who's a hunter knows that if you shoot an animal, the animal takes off running and has a period of time before the animal will collapse. There are also numerous articles in the medical literature that talk of this very point of the unusual things that people are capable of doing either by being shot or stabbed in their heart. So this is pretty much settled science. This is not something that's an aberration. It's well documented in the literature.
And has it been for a long time?
Yes, it has for the long time. I think the oldest article that I was able to find in the literature was from the 1800s.
Civil rights attorney Ben Crump is working with the family of Corey Jones. He shared their reaction to the case thus far and an opinion on some of the evidence.
What they're hoping for is justice. They are watching now the defense experts try to spin and change the narrative to fit his version of events. The problem is facts are very stubborn realities. And once they're out there, it's hard to try to bend untruth to make it fit the truth. And so what you see here, especially these asinine thoughts that a person with a bullet through his heart could run a football field and a half, they want you to believe the illogical to try to convince you that he should be exonerated versus just going with common sense and then arriving based on the evidence in the law and your common sense that this is the person who committed a crime and should be held accountable regardless of the fact that he is a police officer. Can you imagine being stranded on the side of the road at 3 o'clock in the morning, how vulnerable that must be? And Corey's there, and all of a sudden this strange white cargo van pulls up. A person jumps out of the car, and he has on jeans, a T-shirt, and a baseball cap. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning on the side of the road, and he confronts Corey, never identifying himself as a police officer. Corey family believes he went to his grave never knowing who this strange person was who was confronting him. And remember, Corey had a gun, but he never fired his weapon. He was running away. So that tells you the character of the person of this young man.
Law and Crime President Rachel Stockman is with me tonight here on The Debrief. Rachel, this is a case where we have multiple theories about the recording, multiple theories about whether or not the victim was running away. A lot for the jury to chew on.
Sure, and I think right there, you said it, that could be reasonable doubt in terms of a conviction for the highest manslaughter with a weapon charge, but there's a lot of degrees here. And, you know, I think there's a real possibility that jurors could find him guilty of a lesser charge.
Yeah, we have the state saying that Corey Jones was probably advancing, was shot in the heart, probably fell shortly thereafter, and presumably that Newman Raja shot him when he was on the ground to so-called finish the job off. The defense has got this competing expert up there saying, no. He could have been running away with the gun in his hand, not respecting Officer Raja's wishes, and therefore still posing a threat. The jury has to try to reconcile these theories.
Yeah, and I think the fact that the defense called the state's chief medical examiner as their witness is certainly a very strong expert when you look at the scale there.
Yeah, I mean, one medical examiner and then the top guy in the state trying to conflict with it. And
who then the prosecution actually originally had on their list to call.
Exactly. So they're back and forth on that, and then we have the recording. We've got this defense expert saying there's something in there in the beginning that we can't make out, and might that be Raja identifying himself as an officer? We don't know.
I think that's pretty weak.
Well, it might raise reasonable doubt in the mind of at least one juror.
It could, potentially, but I just don't think there's a whole lot to grab onto there.
Well, we'll have to see what the jury says. Rachel Stockman, great to see you tonight.
Great to see you, too.
And thanks for watching this edition of The Daily Debrief. I'll be back tomorrow at 5 o'clock Eastern on the Law and Crime Network with this nightly recap of the best moments in testimony nationwide. Live trial coverage begins a little early tomorrow at 8:30 Eastern for closing arguments in the Newman Raja case. Have a good night.